Be good to go. Okay, today is June 6, 2014, and it's Karen Brewster and Dave Klein continuing on the journey through Dave's life here at his home in Fairbanks, Alaska. And let's start up again with when you were the research coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Juneau.
Yep.
And remind me what years that was.
Well, this was coordinating the research, and most of the research was funded through a national program based on excise taxes on arms and ammunition for hunting. And that was through an act of Congress called congressmen who were involved with Pittman and Robertson. So that was the term we often used in-house, was PR, Pittman Robertson funding for wildlife research. So, but it was a federal program for wildlife research that gave money to each of the states that based on the size of the state and the number of hunting licenses sold in each state.
It's kind of like the Land and Water Conservation Fund thing.
So because of Alaska's size, immense size, and we had enough hunters that we got the maximum amount along with Texas and New York. New York because of numbers and Texas because it was big like Alaska.
Okay.
So that was good funding for wildlife research. That went to Fish and Game, and there was certain ways you could use that and certain ways you couldn't. You couldn't use it for enforcement, law enforcement, wildlife law enforcement. You could use it for habitat improvement, research on the species like moose or caribou. You could do research on them and their habitat, and that was the way it was used primarily. And my job there was to be sure that the biologists within the organizations working with these species, mainly the big charismatic species like moose, caribou, bears, etc., were spending this money according to the federal regulations. And we had to submit reports, I think annual reports, maybe less than annual, maybe it was biannual, and on what was being done. And my job was in putting those reports together, but also I did visit a lot of the project, and that was a positive side of things. I mean, I got to go to the Fog Knack and spend a couple of days with the fellow that was working with the elk there. And so I learned a lot about elk habitat that I didn't know previously. I knew a hell of a lot about deer ecology because that was what I was working with. But these others, I knew quite a bit about caribou because I'd worked as a graduate student up there with people that are working with caribou and field work myself, mountain sheep and others. But yeah, I got around and that was a positive thing, but it wasn't my research. And so my research was hanging over my shoulders and had to do the final analysis of data and write up of the thesis. Well, in that 1 year I got, and that was all done at home because I was full-time in the office, and even though I wasn't busy, I could have worked on it, but I was busy. It was a full-time job.
And what year was this that you started that job?
That was in 1961, and we moved up, drove up over the highway in our VW Bug that we had bought when we first went down there in Seattle, and that was ideal car for us, a small family. We learned to live with little kids, and I remember going through customs in Canada, when Vancouver, from Seattle to go to the semester, beginning the academic year, and I had this mountain goat meat that was frozen, and we got it down there, and then I think a friend who was a step relative from my wife that we stayed with, and so we were able to put the keep the meat in the freezer, and we were operating on a minimal budget, and this was a young mountain goat that I hunted just before I went down, and it was top quality meat, and it was all bundled up and frozen, and so we realized that there might be a problem in going into Canada with this wild meat, and so we figured, I was not good at lying, so we put it in the little place behind the back seat. There was virtually no trunk space in the VW Bug. There was this little place and one or two niches under the seats, and so we put stuff in there, and then we put some insulating blankets over it so to keep it from thawing. And then we had two children, and the youngest one we put up there because they would go to sleep when we were driving. And so we went, came to the checkpoint in the border and going into Canada, and so I remember my wife had a nice giant shell. I think it was a giant
like a clam shell?
No, it was a giant what are the things that grow on the rocks? They're not mussels.
Mussels.
The ones that you don't eat normally. Barnacles.
Barnacles.
A giant barnacle. Occasionally ones that wash up on the beach, and I saved this one and it made a nice planter. And we had this nice little plant in there, a small plant. And my wife had that one. And so when we got to this station and said, oh, what do you have any plants and or fruit? I said, no, but we had this one plant. Well, we've got this one, and take that. You have to leave that here. And my wife, Arlene, said, no, this is important. And so I said, well, you can't take that plant in there. And it's the planter that we want to take in. This is an important to us. And so he let us dump the plant in the trash and take this planter back. And then the Peggy Helen was asleep in the back. And so he did a quick view and didn't investigate what was underneath Peggy Ellen, which was the meat that we... So he didn't ask me questions I had to lie about in that regard. And so at any rate, we got the meat, and yeah, we ate a lot of that meat. And when we got... we're living in campus housing, and that was good because there were a lot of other married families with kids, and there was a good play area, and Arlene could make friends there. It was a good place for all of us.
And that was at UBC?
UBC, yeah.
Okay.
So then when I'd finished up the 2 years of residency, academic years of residency at UBC, and then I would come back in the summer to Petersburg and continue with the deer research that I was doing, the deer habitat research on comparing two islands, and which was part of my dissertation research, and then go back in the end of summer before the beginning of the semester and meet up in Walla Walla with my wife and step grandparents and then drive to.
Because when you were doing that summer field research, your wife and children stayed with her relatives
with
in
her
Walla
parents,
Walla?
With her parents in Walla Walla. So the grandparents, and they were happy with that arrangement, and they had plenty of room because their children had mostly been fledged. And
well, so your job with Fish and Game then in 61, that was, Fish and Game was a fairly new organization.
Yep.
Right after statehood.
Yeah, because when statehood came, then I was working for Fish and Wildlife, and then Fish and Wildlife's responsibility for management of Fish and Wildlife throughout Alaska, except on national parks and wildlife refuges, transferred to the state. So the state had to create create a Department of Fish and Game that actually had a Department of Fisheries for about 2 years before statehood, gearing up for the statehood. And so then it became the Department of Fish and Game. And so I had my choice of, there were no positions with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska because they were scaling back then.
And you had, before you went to British Columbia, you'd been a Fish and Wildlife Service employee, and you were guaranteed, you continued to have a job when you finished? Or
no.
The summers were?
I was, because in 1959, Alaska became a state. At that point, I had to make a decision as to whether to stay with Fish and Wildlife, and the only positions available would be in the lower 48, and you would be on lists, and they would, if there was a position on a refuge somewhere, they would announce, and you could ask to be considered for that transfer in that position. So you could stay with Fish and Wildlife, but you couldn't stay with in Alaska.
Right.
Or at least I could not, in that I was only been there for 5 years. So then the options were, and neither my wife or I wanted to leave Alaska. So, you know, if we would have, of course, if nothing else. So we did, it wasn't as if we didn't have a job, but we wanted to stay in Alaska. And so then the other option was to quit Fish and Wildlife Service and go to work for Department of Fish and Game, because they were eager to hire me if I was do that, and because they were gearing up, and the people that were at the top, well, some of them were students that I had been a student with at the UAF doing a master's degree, and
right.
So I knew these people, and you know, one was a more senior guy who had just started a graduate degree later in life, and he turned out, Jim Brooks, to be the heading. He had worked for this new fisheries organization, first working with marine mammals, and then he became head of the, what it was called then, instead of Division of Wildlife Conservation, the Division of Game, Game Division. So they would hire me, but I discussed this with him, and I said, but I want to take educational leave and do this PhD degree. So this was an anticipation of statehood when it was pretty sure that it was coming. And so then I was able to finish up the transfer to Fish and Game as statehood, and I continued to finish up my field work on the PhD dissertation work in on deer ecology in Southeast Alaska, and during the summertime, and then I'd go back to UBC for the 2 years. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't save my job, but they would have a job for me. They would have a job for me.
So that was that 1961 research coordinator was the job they had for you when you were done with your 2 years.
Yeah, and was what was available because, you know, they were a growing organization. They didn't know for sure which job, but I was confident that a job at my original salary level would be more than I could expect. Mm-hmm. And they sort of guaranteed that. But then by the time I had gotten the PhD or almost got it, then they realized that I could take on more of an administrative leadership position, which I was happy to do, because I needed the time to finish up and needed the income to recover from, because they didn't pay me when I was on educational leave,
right.
Only in the summer while I was doing the research.
Right.
So it was close margin in terms of financing the PhD.
And so 61, you started that job in Juneau, and when did you get the PhD?
Well, then while I was, shortly after I got there, within several months, this position opened up on campus heading up the Wildlife Research Unit.
At UAF.
At UAF. And they asked me if I was interested in the position. They were trying to search. They had some temporary people who were from other states that came up on an interim basis to fill the position, but most of them didn't. They wanted to stay where they were, but they were helping out. And so part of it was their wives didn't want to come too. And it was a different era then too. And then, so at any rate, I turned it down initially because I said I'd just taken this job and I felt a commitment to stick with it, and which I did. And then just before the end of the fiscal year, that was in the end of June, state fiscal year, it was about April maybe or May, they approached me again and said, would I be interested in taking the position? And it was actually the ideal position for me that I thought I might achieve sometime in the more distant future. But I said, well, haven't quite finished my PhD yet, and that was a requirement. And I felt a commitment to stay with Fish and Game through the budgeting year at least. But I felt a commitment to Jim Brooks, who had hired me, and they were, I'd been on educational leave, and so I hadn't been doing much except my own PhD. And so second time I went and talked to Jim Brooks, and he said he really appreciated my loyalty, but personally he said that I'd rather have you stay, but if I was in your position, I'd go. And so I recommend you do that. It'll be in your best interest, and you'll be working closely with us anyway, because of the Cooperative Wildlife mm-hmm. Research Unit was one of the cooperatives was the State Department of Fish and Game. And so that made that position more important for me from the standpoint of both the Department of Fish and Game, but also my employees, who would be the Fish and Wildlife Service again, although the position, I would be technically a member of the university faculty, and I would be getting my salary from the Fish and Wildlife Service. I'd have two bosses. I'd have the boss in Washington heading up the Cooperative Wildlife Unit program throughout the states at land-grant colleges, where there was like some 30-some of these units. And but also I was technically considered a faculty member without salary from the university. So I had to go through evaluations for promotion from assistant professor to associate and full professor, et cetera, to be considered and to function as a faculty member as well. And that had teaching and research responsibilities through the university.
So you got reviewed and went through the whole university professorial tenure process, but you also were a Fish and Wildlife Service employee who got...
Well, we didn't call it tenure because the university didn't give me... they didn't even have tenure at that time, but they didn't... I wouldn't qualify for tenure or sabbatical because that's paid for by the university. If I was going to do anything like that, it had to be through the Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington and the budget that they had that paid for salary of these people.
It's confusing that you were paid by Fish and Wildlife Service, but you worked for the university.
That's right, but remember, this is a cooperative wildlife research unit. So state and federal governments were working together and supporting of it, as well as the university. So there was a memorandum of understanding that said the university would provide an office and lab space and the secretary, and they would pay for telephones and operating the office. And the Fish and Wildlife Service would pay for the salary and all the benefits that go through it through the Fish and Wildlife Service. So okay. You're an employee, technically. And then the Department of Fish and Game contributed a token amount specifically designed to support graduate student stipends. Mm-hmm. And then there was a fourth organization called the Wildlife Management Institute, which was largely a lobbying organization based in Washington. They contributed a token amount of a few thousand dollars because they were lobbying for the whole program nationwide. And that was important. They were able to keep Congress supporting their share mm-hmm. of the program. So some of the challenges, of course, were at the Wildlife Unit, East Wildlife Unit, was you had to keep on good relations with the university and with the State Department of Fish and Game, whatever it is, and as well as meeting your federal requirements. And there were real standards for merit advancement in the federal, which were like the university, that you had to go up for review and then you moved up in position and salary. But in the university, as a faculty member, you had a contract, and they you had to pay, technically they paid you $1 a year because of some legal aspect of how this was drawn up, and you had to go through review for advancement to a higher faculty position, from assistant professor to associate, but there was no salary for the university involved, and you didn't receive salary from the university. And part of the job of the unit leader was to both advise graduate students through the program, but it was also to seek additional funding to support their research. So in addition to some money from Fish and Game for stipends, it was only for stipends. And if there was research, we had to negotiate. Sometimes we could get in-kind support with flights from Fish and Wildlife or Fish mm-hmm. and Game. So we had the advantage of being able to work with state and federal organizations and do projects that they could, it was more economical to have a student do a master's degree on it, whereas they didn't have the, their staff wouldn't have the expertise necessarily or the time to focus on this one project without hiring additional people. So it was often was a better deal for them. Plus we had an agreement too with the university that overhead would be 10% on income coming in from agencies and support organizations. And that often they waived overhead on stipend money coming in, but this was important on research money. Whereas for the rest, if you were going through a federal agency for research like the National Science Foundation, the university had to take overhead of, might be nowadays, it's over 50%.
Yeah, it's like 50%.
And it used to be maybe 20%, or it was considerably higher than the 10% we had.
And you said part of it was to seek money for support for graduate student research. What about support for any of your own research?
Well, I did have a salary and a small budget that covered mostly travel expenses to do my job. But then I was free to do research if I could fund it. And sometimes the research I would do would be in association with a student and getting a student started on a project, and I would be doing, like if I was working on, mostly at that early stage I was looking at it, plant-animal interactions between large herbivores, that was caribou, moose, muskoxen, mountain sheep, etc. And but mainly caribou at first, and then later others like muskoxen, and then some with moose and some with mountain sheep and a little bit with mountain goats. And so a lot of it was associative work that I would be in the area where I could do some incidental to working with the students. And other was I was able to apply through organizations, state, federal agencies, and Fish and Wildlife and National Science Foundation or others, like the St. Matthew Island work. Mm-hmm. I usually had to get some additional funding. And sometimes the university would chip in some travel money, and we'd arrange for transportation from the Coast Guard without, you know, they wouldn't charge us, and but getting field assistant and other things, we would get money. Sometimes I'd have to get a special grant from the Fish and Wildlife for that, or from the National Science Foundation. So some of the work I did in Greenland was the National Science Foundation, or was from other organizations, both in the U.S. and outside, who wanted me to be involved in a bigger project. And so they would have funding to pay for my expenses to be involved and come. But my salary was covered by the Fish and Wildlife Service. So it was an advantage. I didn't have to go for my salary when I was working on these other projects. Okay. It was a good arrangement in many ways. It was challenging because I had some administration responsibility associated with the support for the students in the program, and not just my students, but others who were being advised. Major professors might be faculty in the biology and wildlife program, but I still had to be responsible for their funding of the students' research. Worked that out in advance, but then monitored it, and then I had to count on secretarial support to help me with the accounting and stuff, and at the same time teaching only one course a year at the graduate level was a required minimum. Sometimes you did two, but mostly it was one at the graduate level, which was good for me and good for the program. Mm-hmm. And then I was free to to be, and I'd advise students that I was advising, but I served on committees of other students in the program, in the biology and wildlife. So I had these commitments as part of as a faculty member as well, and attend faculty meetings as well as administrative and university administration meetings. It was like the wildlife unit was like a mini research institute. So I sat on panels that were institute directors and what, and which was time-consuming and sometimes seemingly not too productive, but it was important to maintain the presence and recognition of the cooperative program within the university system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an unusual cooperation, and potentially very confusing administratively.
It could be, but fortunately we quickly melded into the departments, the university departments, and then the Institute of Arctic Biology when the Biology and Wildlife Program moved into, well, faculty did research through the Institute of Arctic Biology, and then we were technically part of that, so that we could help them bring in research funding, but they could help us at times in developing proposals and working out the details. So we had additional support, administrative support from other people, and we finally just turned over our budget to the IAB, and they have a business office, and that relieved a lot of tension between my secretary, who was handling it at the time. But gradually the program grew, and so then we had another professional assistant unit leader that could share the responsibilities, and we eventually merged with the fisheries, cooperative fishery unit, which came into existence much later. The wildlife, cooperative wildlife unit came into existence at UAF in 1950, whereas the fishery unit, it was in the 1980s, I think, that they first started operating independently, and eventually we were merged with them.
And when did you merge?
It's a good question. I have to check the dates on that. When we merged, it was about in the 80s or mid-80s, I think. And then they offered me because I had seniority, and they were happy with me as an administrator of the whole system, and I said I would not be happy with the whole system because I didn't want to take on additional administrative responsibility. So they a special position was created through the Fish and Wildlife Service, and of a senior scientist with the Joint Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. So then the fisheries unit, Jim Reynolds, became the unit leader, and I was a senior scientist and continued advising students, doing my own research, but I had less administrative responsibility. Mm-hmm. And there was more responsibility for research, and especially there were more controversial things that I was experienced with, like oil development, pipeline constructions, and effects on wildlife habitat, etc.
So what year did you start at UAF?
1962. Okay. And I retired officially from the cooperative unit program in 1997. I think that's 35 years.
Yeah.
So I was not all that eager to retire because I was enjoying the work. But by that time I was pulling down a big salary within the cooperative program because I had moved up to the top level in the Fish and Wildlife Service. So during tough budget years, it was hard for me to be drawing that big salary, and there were assistant unit positions agreed, additional assistant unit positions agreed, but not filled because of budget constraints. And other units had perhaps greater problems because they, through a retirement of a unit leader, they weren't even able to fill the unit leader position. So I said I would not retire unless it was agreed that my salary money would stay with the Alaska unit, because the Alaska unit was by this time considered perhaps the most important in all of the United States because of the size and importance of wildlife research and management in Alaska, and with all of these federal reserves in Alaska as well. And and we had a good record, built a good record of turning out good students, et cetera, and doing good science, and frequently a good record of doing research on controversial issues where the state and federal government were at odds with one another, but the cooperative unit, we worked together. So that was one of the benefits of the cooperative unit as the statehood, as states started to mature, they tended to resent federal jurisdiction. But within the unit, we were able to work together on things where they're jointly funded by state and federal government, and then sometimes oil industry and others were kicking in money. But we had the advantage of serving state and federal interests at the same time, at least working for compromise, and it worked out well. And so we had respect from both federal and state, because we were part federal and part state, technically, and part university. So it was a good program. When we'd be challenged that the university budget was being cut, we had to go through and re-educate the chancellor or whatever as to how complex this arrangement was, and the university was getting so much out of it at a very low amount, and we could then justify maintaining our state budget through the university, and sometimes we had to do that with the Department of Fish and Game as well, but pretty successful in the long run.
Well, getting the state and the federal governments to agree on wildlife management issues was potentially challenging.
It was challenging, but we had this. We had in the early days, which I was familiar with, of statehood, there was a lot more collaboration between the federal and state, because the federal government attitude was, you know, let's help the state get going and take over because they don't have much experience at this. And the state felt, yeah, we appreciate this kind of help. And it was like everybody was working together for the well-being of the resource. Mm-hmm. And then later on, it started changing, partly for political economic reasons like oil development. The state administration's attitude was, don't hold up construction of the pipeline or oil field development with all of these rules and regulations regarding wildlife. Whereas Fish and Wildlife Service attitude was, of course, different. And our attitude was we working really for the well-being of the resource for the present and the future. And therefore, that's what we're training students to do, rather than to work and be loyal to the state or being loyal to the federal government. And I was frequently on the firing line, and so I did some publishing on the philosophy and ethics of wildlife management, and where does the loyalty of a wildlife biologist or wildlife manager lie? So, does it lie with the agency you work for, whether state or federal or a private consulting firm, or does it lie with doing being responsible in managing, doing research and treating your research and to manage for the well-being of the resource and its sustainability and production and management in the future, rather than to work for the oil industry. And some of the consulting firms, you know, were actually for the oil industry, were hired to and were signed to do research to discredit sometimes state and sometimes federal, and sometimes it was hard to do it for the wildlife unit. When the oil industry hired us to do something, they wanted to, at first they wanted a contract that said they had control over publication and they owned the data. And I said, we can't operate that way. I said, we have to, the data and information has to be out in the public. And so, what we did in one case where we had a study of a simulated pipeline that we had been critical of the oil industry, that they didn't know how to build a pipeline to accommodate movements of caribou. And we would, and nor did we, we need to do some research to find out. And so they agreed to support a PhD level study simulating building a pipeline up in Prudhoe Bay and using different kind of crossings on the pipeline. Well, they were willing to kick in all this money because we'd criticized them, and now they said, okay, you can do the research and we'll fund this and we'll build a pipeline. And it was 2 miles long, I think, and with observation towers and what. But they said, but the contract that they had control of the data. And I said, well, we can't do it. They said they had to have, they had to review the data first, and that's, otherwise the money wasn't coming. And I contacted Fish and Wildlife Service, my supervisor, and I said, this was, I don't know, it was about $80,000 that was money, which was pretty good funding from the oil industry. I said, can you kick in $5,000 or $10,000? And then it'll be, we'll have to, they'd have to agree that since it was federal, some federal funding, it would have to be open for public scrutiny. And so they did that, and the oil industry, they didn't want the publicity to get out that they were rejecting it on that basis. And so they approved it, and things worked okay, but it didn't last very long before they were up there, and they weren't supposed to release preliminary information while we're doing the research,
right,
on either side. And so they had some press and photographers up there, and their employee, their biologists, so-called, took them around and showed them what we were doing, and the caribou were moving. And they said, yeah, we're already seeing that most of the caribou are going over the pipeline, fine. Well, they didn't have any basis for saying that. We had all the data. Nobody, we were doing the observations. And so we complained about that. And they, you know, said, well, I was, we shouldn't have done that, maybe. But they didn't. And then they went ahead and tried to block publication when we, for the student, he'd been invited to a Congress, and he was presenting the data that was analyzed and what, showing that, yeah, 25% of the animals were crossing, using crossings, and the other 75% were deflected by the pipeline. And they were using some crossings better than others. They weren't going under overhead pipelines very well. They were if they were using crossings, they'd use these gravel ramps that over the pipeline. So They threatened to take us to court, and we got contacted. The federal government lawyers looked at it and said, no, this was the wording of the contract, and you should be able to do this. We had similar problems later on when one of our students, while not my advisee, but another one, was doing a study of insects and how that affected the movement of animals up in the oil field as it was developing. And he published some information, or they published some information, which was unsoundly based and contradictory to what he was finding. So he wrote a letter to the editor, I think, of the local newspaper saying, you know, this is unethical behavior. And the oil industry sent a subpoena to him saying he was being charged with illegally releasing this information when they had already released it themselves. And they released it not in Alaska, they released it in Seattle. So it came out in the Seattle newspaper that they released the information. And so they, of course, the university in that case came to the, their lawyers came into defense of the student, and they pointed out that, you know, the oil industry, you know, was probably willing to spend megabucks just to save face, and that, you know, this was going to come out in the open because we'd go to court over this. So they backed off, mm-hmm. and he was able to criticize openly what they were doing, and thought they could disquiet him by threatening him with legal action. At any rate, I mean, that's not unusual, I guess, with when you're working with industry.
Right, but as the cooperative unit leader, you had to sort of negotiate all this and mediate and be in the middle of it all?
We had to try to maintain our credibility as well as not polarize arguments over issues. And so we had to stick to our basic science and the fact that we were doing things scientifically, and it was subject to review and criticism, but we clearly distrusted what they were trying to do. And it was an error when, you know, there were some of these consulting firms which would take the money from the oil industry and do what the oil industry asked them to do. And they were asking them to, say, do counter science, and that especially Exxon was terrible about that, and trying to discredit the work of others. And not just us, Department of Fish and Game was doing good research up there and flying regularly, and they tried to discredit his objective of the so he happened to be a PhD student that did his degree work here and was well trained, but and he was a pilot and had his own plane up there, and a Super Cub, which the oil industry didn't use those little planes, and so he could do these good survey work, whereas when they did fast Cessnas, they couldn't do as good an observation as he was doing. At any rate, we had problems, and yeah, we frequently would come to the support of Fish and Game because they were doing good science. We were collaborating with them frequently, and they were providing support to us too. And the Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, was, but I mean, that was sort of the trend of the things at the time. And we had, you know, some oil industries were really good, some oil companies were really good, and some were they'd have us do studies to help them know where to put, where the caribou were moving in the summertime, and where there were major movement rates frequently depended upon the lakes, and they would be moving between lakes to get to the insect relief area close to the coast. So once we did the mapping of all of these movement patterns, they could see that what they had originally planned to put a construction camp right in the pass for the caribou, they said, well, we can move that pretty easily. It's not a question of drilling for oil or anything like that. It's a question of where it's convenient for us, but up there it wouldn't be significantly different to move it, maybe a little longer road or something like that. And companies that were pretty good at that time, there were different companies, because there was BP at that time was pretty good, and Exxon and Exxon Phillips or whatever they were at the time.
Exxon Mobil
were not particularly good. And then Conoco was not ConocoPhillips then. It was a smaller, and they were super good because they, provided logistics support and housing for the student that was doing the work. And then they, when he wrote it up, that Conoco component, I mean, they're worldwide at the time, but that it was a small unit up on the North Slope then, and that Conoco was developing, and they got an award for doing the conservation work and gave it to the wildlife unit and the student for doing good studies on insect harassment and how road construction would relate to that and that area. And it was a way we felt quite honored to have the oil industry provide this honor. And this particular student went on to be, he's still based in Kotzebue for Fish and Game. He's one of their best biologists. Mm-hmm. It was great to have that happen. So it, and I, some of the oil people I worked with, one-on-one, some of them were really good, and some of them, they were sincere and were trying to minimize the impact on caribou and or other wildlife, and others were, just sort of polarized, right? We don't want any more restriction on us. You should be lucky that we're doing all this for you and for the state of Alaska, et cetera, et cetera. It's a bunch of baloney. And during that era, although it wasn't directly through the unit, but it was a similar time when we were sending people up there, the professor, botanist Dave Murray, he was asked to do some botanical studies that required systematic studies, which was his the plant species, and included work with mosses. Mm-hmm. Well, his wife was an expert on mosses, and so he put together this proposal, and the industry initially went out for a review at the top level, and they didn't look to see that his wife was female, and there were not allowed in the oil field females.
Right.
And so from the standpoint of the oil field, and so they said, well, they couldn't support it because couldn't have women up there. And so Dave Murray said they would camp out in the field, and they finally, and not use the bunkhouses, the workers. And that was the problem, the staying in with only men. Mm-hmm. And so it was approved, but then when it came down to, they came up and said, no, we can't have that happen because we're responsible, and they wouldn't have any potty place.
Or what if a bear comes or something,
And so they said, no, it's, and so then the university got involved in all this, and finally they said, okay, we'll make an exception, and so that you can stay in the workplace, and that they would have to close one of these toilet shower deals where they had two in one camp and make it mm-hmm. women only.
It should be women only.
Well, that was the point. And so Dave said, we don't have to close the whole thing. Can't you just, have a portion of it? Oh, that's, it wasn't constructed that way, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't want them in close and have hours,
Yeah, just put up a sign
that. And that was a solution of hours that seemed realistic. And they said, no, this is men there. And they can't be trusted when with women around. We don't want any women up there. It was like when I was up there and you'd fly into Dead Horse and Alaska Airlines would come in there a couple times a day. And they were, and even initially, they couldn't be women at Dead Horse. Well, mm-hmm. that was a state. They get over that in short order. But they, and sometimes in the early days, before Dead Horse, it was Exxon Phillips Airfield. And we'd fly in there, and Alaska Airlines would come in, and the stewardesses were not allowed to get off the plane. Mm-hmm. And there would be a bunch of guys off duty, and they would head there with their binoculars just so they could look at a woman when they opened the door and see the stewardesses in the plane. I mean, talk about strange.
Well, the women not being allowed out in the field and on the projects is the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory in Barrow had that same policy. Women weren't allowed to, Florence Weber and Florence Collins, who were early geologists, couldn't go do research up there because they weren't allowed.
Right. But coming back to the early days of the co-op unit, we had only men that were applying for graduate work in wildlife and biology. So we didn't, the graduate program there was the first graduate program at the university organized. There were a couple through the Geophysical Institute, PhDs, but they were, they weren't using coursework and stuff. They were doing research over many years and then finally officially examined, et cetera, and had to do thesis, but independent of any graduate program. So there was none of the faculty were expected to do any graduate teaching. So the co-op unit changed things a bit. And so they gradually, in addition to the unit people, the unit leader and assistant unit leader, some faculty were taking on students if they got research funding that would allow them to buy out of some of their teaching, then they would be able to maybe teach on graduate programs through the research money they were bringing in. So it was the co-op unit really initiated the graduate programs in the life sciences.
Here at UAF.
Here at UAF.
So right. That would have been in biology, wildlife management.
Those two first.
Mm-hmm.
And later, natural resource management. Yeah.
And what about fisheries? That was separate.
Fisheries was part, at the early days, was part of the biology program.
Oh, okay.
Biology and wildlife. So we had a fishery, faculty of fishery guy, and then later more. Yeah, and before the Institute of Marine Science.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, they're faculty and good ones too. But, when I was doing my master's degree, there were one student doing a study through the same co-op wildlife unit then, a study of grayling ecology.
Mm-hmm. But he was under the wildlife department.
Yeah. And one of the advisors was a state fishery biologist, one of the members of the committee who had played a big role, and that was a good deal,
So you said there were no women graduate students when you first started?
None applying initially, and then finally the first one applied, and I forget her name, but she, yeah, she had the qualifications, but there was, and there were, you know, there were no women faculty as well.
Well, that was my other question.
Yeah, so there are no women faculty, but not, I shouldn't say no, because there were a few, like Rina Kessel and Drusilla Scheibel was, before the Wildlife Unit was established, she was taught biology, and she was, you know, a tremendous teacher, but she had been around for quite a while, and there were some women students, of course, in the university, undergraduate level,
but so Bryna and would you say her name?
Drusilla Scheibel.
Scheibel, they taught in the just the plain old biology department, not the wildlife cooperative wildlife unit.
I don't know what it was called when Drusilla Scheibel was there. They obviously didn't have a department.
But she taught biology classes somehow.
Yeah, she taught only biology, yeah. And
same with Bryna. They weren't in the wildlife unit. They just taught biology classes because the unit didn't exist.
Well, Bryna was hired after she came there in 1951 or 52. So it's a year. She was there 1 year before I, as a faculty member, before I came to start the wildlife master's degree.
Okay.
So I took a course from her.
Well, that's pretty early on, though, to have a woman science professor, 1951.
Well, but it wasn't true in liberal arts universities. And in top universities in Lower 48, there weren't that many, but they were there. If they were good, had a good training and good background and good scientists, yeah, they definitely, some of them were top notch.
Mm-hmm. But so who was the first woman faculty in the cooperative unit?
Here at UAF.
Right. Do you remember?
I think it was the assistant fishery unit for the fisheries unit, and that was, I'll think of her name. She was assistant unit leader for quite a while and did good research, and then after the marine science started up, she collaborated a lot with them. But she was good.
And so she was the assistant unit leader for the fisheries unit.
Yep.
Okay.
But I mean, then later on others came in, but of course there wasn't that much replacement and new positions for a long time.
And do you remember the first female graduate student?
Well, that was this woman that I think Fred Dean was her advisor, and she worked for the Park Service after that, and she was dog handler down at the park for a while, but she was a park naturalist, and she died just recently. She's been retired for quite a number of years, and I could check it easily.
I'm sure I can find out too. But do you have a sense of what time period that was? That was the '60s, the '70s.
It was probably the either late '60s or early '70s. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it sounds like the work as being a unit leader took a lot of people skills and negotiating and to get the feds and the state and the university and everybody to get along?
Yes and no, but I mean, it was mainly, I mean, part of the problem we frequently had, I didn't have it very much, but other unit leaders in Colorado and other places was to meld the unit into the academic components.
Mm-hmm.
And you weren't required to do that. So, I mean, it was Colorado, I think, was one that they had, they remained separate. And so, you know, and on campus it was like the feds for the wildlife unit,
mm-hmm.
which it's bad, you know, because they were polarized then, if you call them the feds. Whereas here, I mean, I made a great effort to be a faculty member, but partly because that's what you're doing. You're on campus, and the fed part of it was mainly bringing in money. And they were paying my salary, but my job was to advise graduates. My primary job was to advise graduate students and be a leader for students and the whole program. And so I was frequently called on to be on committees, which I wasn't, my expertise wasn't there, but I was a professor, and so I was, there was one student in botany, and Steve, any rate, he turned out to be a leader. He eventually started a program at a small university in Vermont and continued to do Arctic research in Alaska and elsewhere. And he's done some of the best publications from him. But he was
McLean, not Steve McLean, no.
No, long before him.
Oh.
And but he was he did his master's on blueberries.
Oh.
And I you know, would kid him that he loved blueberry pie. That's why he chose it. But he was.
Well, I've thought about that I like blueberries so much, maybe I should go do a PhD on blueberries.
But he's a terrific guy and a good sense of humor. And he did classic work on the vegetation of the St. Lawrence Island.
Oh.
And then of the Arctic in general and all of the Circumarctic as well. And.
But you mentioned how you primarily advised graduate students and was a leader for the students. Was that typical for unit leaders around the country, or that was something unique to you or unique to UAF?
It was, I'd say it was about typical, more than 50% were that way. I started some programs that was to try to bring the co-op units closer together. We'd have our annual meetings, and one of the programs I said it would be valuable for us to do exchanges, so unit leaders with other units.
And, yeah, I remember you mentioned that before, yeah.
Yeah, and a supervisor in Washington thought it was a good idea, but it didn't fit into the budgetary system, because to pay for people to travel to be an assistant leader and to pay all of the living expenses and everything if you're a visiting unit. Well, I discussed this with a few of the unit leaders who thought it was a good idea, and when we had an annual meeting, and then I said, you know, we can work out a deal where it's exchange, you just live with the family and mm-hmm. home, and so you don't, there's no cost except, you know, a little bit of cost, but then it's an exchange, and they do the reverse when they come to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And the travel was an issue, but once they realized we'd kind of work it out ourselves, and so it wouldn't be a high cost thing, high budgetary thing. So then they approved it, and so I and a few others were the only ones that did it, and it was mostly the others were the ones that exchanged that. I did it with the Ohio unit, the first one, and he was a guy that we got along very well, and he was a younger guy, and the guy that had been the unit leader was Drabnach, and he moved into a faculty position and stayed with the university for a number of years, and so he was very supportive of the unit program, and he supported the idea of the exchange. So we had that exchange, and I mean, some of the other units say, why the unit leader of Alaska want to go and do an exchange with Ohio? And I said, I was one that did, yeah, because I knew that it would be good if I went with him, and I'd give some lectures, and he'd get me out in the field. And yeah, they did a lot of waterfowl work, and it's fascinating, and we went visited different field areas. Yeah, I mean, so to come to Alaska on an exchange, you're not going to see all of Alaska in a week or 10 days' time. And so we usually did a terrific thing. We'd tie them in with a field course, and they'd go down to Southeast, and then they were with the students, with me, and it was beneficial to have somebody else just from another university, mm-hmm. and they got to know the students and had a wonderful time.
And so did that exchange so the guy from Ohio came here and then you went to Ohio? It was always
I went first there and then he came right. here. And so we could plan it to be the best to get out in the
so
field.
So Ovi's went both directions?
Pardon? Not at the same time.
No, but, okay, but if somebody, where else did you go besides Ohio?
Arizona and Virginia, a VPI in Virginia. I think those are the
What's
three.
What's a VPI?
Virginia Polytechnic Institute.
Oh, okay.
And
so their guys came here and then you went down there.
Or vice versa.
Vice versa, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was so, obvious.
And there was the Arizona was, and also the Arizona one was from, there was assistant unit leader, and I went down, and then the assistant unit leader came up. The unit leader wasn't all that interested in doing it, but he was supported, the assistant unit leader doing it. And then the Ohio one was assistant unit leader too, but he was doing some work with bears and drugging bears, and Fish and Game was right into that at this time. So it was good for him to come up. He was a good guy, and it was good to have him come and talk about what he was doing. And then we worked with Fish and Game, and they got him out in the field, and he worked with them. And that resulted in continuing exchanges between Fish and Game, which Fish and Game, you know, it's hard for them to do those kind of things, but this way, he was an expert, and they had experts here, and they could benefit by working together.
But yeah, you mentioned that part of the job was to work with students. So did the cooperative units in the other states also focus so much on students?
Yeah, you would expect to take on a heavy student advisement role, but you're also expected to bring money in to help pay for that, and you're expected to do some of your own research, some of the unit leaders put more focus on administration, or some put more focus on something else, and the one of the differences between the units was some of the units were like here. They were through a biology program or wildlife program, mm-hmm. and the biology and wildlife were together, which I always lobbied for that, rather than separate them, have a separate wildlife program. So, because I felt that basic biology was important, and if you separate them, then the wildlife program tends to be sort of a cookbook, that you have program courses in wildlife, and you don't give them enough of basic sciences to be a good grounding to do this kind of work. At the undergraduate level, that's the important thing, because the undergraduate level, there's certain minimum core courses you got to take, but they're different for the biology and wildlife in many places, but they were the same in here. And so I was pretty biased toward those kind of arrangements that we had here from my experience, and I visit some of the other ones I visited, especially I'd visited on other occasions when I was invited to give talks or something at our conference, and I was down in those other, in the South, in Texas, good universities, but often they were, the separate wildlife program, which you took all these multiple courses, which on wildlife, managing big game, managing fur bears, managing what have you. I mean, it's different in any place, and if you got employed, you got to learn these things after employment. You don't learn it all. And so some of the state agencies, they want courses in how to pack a horse for in Western states for field work. I mean, it's sort of like, do you know how to drive a vehicle?
Well, it's a field methodology, kind of like a field methodology course, but...
Yeah. Should everybody take a course in bear safety?
Well, they make them do it now.
Maybe they do it now, because that's because they are going out in the field. Well, they used to do it only if you were going out. Then everybody had to do it.
Well, now I think they do it. If you're going out in the field, you probably have to take a bear safety and a gun safety.
Right.
Because they're all about safety now.
It doesn't hurt to do that, but that's
different then. It's more.
But
what
you
you're
give
saying
credit,
is it would be like taking a course in how to cook a camp meal.
Yeah. Well, when I was first here, we took. There was a course, but it wasn't. You didn't get graduate credit for it in outdoor cooking.
Mm.
And the one, what's the name of the woman one of the older mess halls is down on campus.
Oh, Lola Tilley?
Lola Tilley she taught home economics. And she was a charming woman. And here we had all these grad students in wildlife. And we were going out in the field and she asked us, I think, one time when she was interacting, because she'd invite us sometimes to come, and when the home ecs would do some cooking and they had some food, and to invite us to come in, and then...
She knew she'd feed a bunch of male graduate students.
It was just like a mom, She said, if I was to offer, we might have influenced her, because we said, we get by, we learned how to do these things the hard way, but frankly, they're just pretty basic. And so she said, she'd offered a course in outdoor cooking that was like once a week for an hour, and I think it was one credit, but we couldn't use that in our degree program, but I took it, and she was such a nice person, and she loved us grad students. So she'd invite us and they'd have tea or something and with cookies and the gals had made, and she'd invite us, we'd go, and that was nice.
Nice.
But she was used to interacting with the experimental farm people, and she knew all about the work that they were doing with the caribou and muskoxen in the early days. It was, and her husband was, he was a high school teacher, I think, and coach. But see, he was just a really nice person.
Well, it was a smaller campus then. You probably all knew each other a little bit better.
Yeah. And then there was another woman teacher that we went to her, us grad students, said, I had a typewriter that, on these little portable typewriters in those days, which was in a little case that my father had, and it was his ribbon and all that stuff, and you had to have strong fingers to push that carriage, especially to make capitals, you know. But I didn't know how to use it. And so, and others, and my, there were typewriters that in the office, the wildlife unit office, and we, as grad students, finally asked this woman who taught typing if she would do a course for us, and she did. So it was just basic typing and you know, touch system. And virtually, I don't know whether, probably not all of the students took it, but probably 80% did. And we all felt good about it. Then I went ahead and I was able to type out rough drafts and things with mine. And it was a pain in the butt because you had to, you know, you couldn't erase very well, and you had to keep replacing tape and stuff. But, you know, I still use a yellow pen. And, but that I got to be moderately good at typing. And then when I got a secretary, I resorted to the
yellow pads.
Yellow pad and give it to her, and she typed stuff up. Are you holding on okay?
Yeah, I'm just thinking I'm going to wrap it up a little
sure.
bit, I think, for tonight. I'm trying to think if we're at a kind of a stopping point. I don't want to end in the middle of something.
I think you could then move on to what I did for master's project and field work associated and gaining experience.
We've done all that.
Oh, we've done all that. That's right.
I was thinking maybe we'd move on to all the students you advised while you were unit leader, and that's a
that'd
whole new topic. And I don't think.
Yeah, that would be good because then.
Because I know that's really important to you.
It is important, and I can touch on some of the diversity. But I've only had 66. Students that I was a major professor of.
Only? Okay, well, that's where we have to start.
And I can't remember the names of all of them.
No,
right
you
now.
Don't have to.
But I have a list somewhere.
Yeah, it seems like, because you've talked about how part of your job was advising students and getting money, and so I think talking about all that would be a good.
Right.
I also have sort of questions about some of the day-to-day administrative bits of history of the unit, and again, I think we'll just start that the next time, if that's
okay. I'll try to think about that a little bit, and and how the students change over time in terms of gender. So I ended up having more female students than other faculty, and as advisees, and I said I just took the best applicants, and it turned out to be frequently females later on, and they had better academic record and experience, etc. And I didn't factor in gender, whereas many of the others were factoring in gender and guys and saying, well, I don't know how you work in the field with a female. And
shouldn't be any different.
Well, it is if you've never done it before.
Yeah.
And you're culturally attuned to the fact that, I remember Dale Guthrie telling me about having a bunch of students and going out on a a field trip, and they were, there was a senior upper division class, wasn't graduate students, and it had to do with paleoecology, and they went and looked at some digs and stuff like that, and out where they're exposing the lus out mm-hmm. here, and Dale said, and this is, there was this one very good-looking young student that most of the guys were tuned in on, and Dale said he didn't blame him. She was just such a nice person. She was a knowledgeable person, and so you know, he said, now when she has to take a pitch, what's she going to do? You know, well, she just said, I'm going over in the bushes, and she did. No big deal. And some of the male students, got all excited. But you know, a simple thing that male mentality is so oriented to sex, and
I thought maybe you could say that all the men were distracted watching her, and they weren't looking at all the paleo things they were supposed to
they
be
were probably
at.
Performing for her. Yeah, displaying for
they
her
were, yeah, I was thinking they were more watching her yeah. than looking at
no that's
specimens.
Definitely can happen, no question about it.
Yeah, okay, well I think we will end for tonight.